You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Christopher DiCarlo is a senior researcher at Convergence. He teaches in the Department of Biology at the University of Toronto and the Life Institute at Toronto Metropolitan University, and is a past visiting research scholar at Harvard. He is the founder of Critical Thinking Solutions, the ethics chair for the Canadian Mental Health Association, a lifetime member of Humanist Canada, and an expert advisor to the Center for Inquiry Canada. He has a new book. It's called Building a God, The Ethics of Artificial Intelligence and the Race to Control It. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Christopher DiCarlo, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So the opening lines of your new book are, quote, "When building a god, we must be very, very careful for we are at the crossroads of perhaps our most unique moment in our short history as a species. For the first time in our existence, we possess the curiosity, capacity, and greed to create an artificially intelligent being or beings so intelligent and so powerful, there is a probable likelihood that its construction may bring about the end of our own existence," end quote. So not a light subject.
No.
Talk to us about you setting out to write this book and why.
Yeah. So you can say I've wanted to write this book since the 90s, because it was during that time I was doing my doctorate and I was teaching students and I was developing ideas that would later form the basis of an idea I had in what's called information theory, which is, if you look at everything in the world, what is it? But there are a multitude of systems. And how do we function? Well, we navigate through those various systems. And all of those systems are interlinked, right? They're all interconnected. And I thought, okay, so what do we teach students here at university? Well, we teach them biology and zoology and chemistry and physics and math and all this really great stuff. But very few people connect the dots to how they're all interrelated. We teach people in silos, and they become experts within those areas. Fine, that's the way the model and the paradigm evolved over time. But I wanted to do more. It occurred to me that we develop technologies and instruments that allow scientists to see very, very far into the universe. So we invent telescopes because our eyes are limited. And then we invent microscopes to see the very, 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 very small. Beyond our capabilities. Why aren't we building large brains that can think far, far better than us? And of course, computers exist, but they didn't exist the way I wanted them to exist, which is, why not create a machine and feed it with the most important information that all the sciences have, and then ask the machine to make inferences for us, to connect dots in ways that humans are limited in doing so that we can cure diseases faster, we can resolve environmental issues quicker, we can give governments better information by which they can make policy and legal decisions, you know, in you know, voting on bills and that sort of thing. So I visited all kinds of chairs, deans, and even presidents of universities, as well as politicians. And I call this thing the Oz Talk Project, the onion skin theory of knowledge, because all these systems, if you put them on the edge, outer edge of an onion, and you went into the onion, the layers of the onion, deeper and deeper and deeper, you have a great depth of knowledge of that one area of study. But if you go around through the layers of the onion, you see how they're all connected. So now you have a breadth of knowledge. So I wanted to take that model and build a machine based on that model, so that in physics and chemistry and economics and geography and history and sociology and art and all of these things, we would understand how they were all interrelated and interconnected, so that when we ask the machine, you know, what is the cause of certain diseases and how can we, you know, fix these problems, it would know much better. It could draw inferences much quicker and much better than humans, because we're very slow and you know, we don't have access to that much information. And then it occurred to me, by the way, I could never get funding for this thing. They all thought it was a great idea. Nobody would give me a dime
Wow.
to build this machine, right? And I thought, you know, somebody is going to. Mm-hmm. In 2015, I met with my MP, and there was an election coming up, and Justin Trudeau was running for the Liberals, and these were Liberal MPs. And I said, if you guys get in, can you guarantee me a meeting with Justin to discuss the Ozark project? Because I think Canada needs to build this thing, because I think it'll serve our Senate extremely well in speeding up decision-making procedures. Yep. We'll get you a meeting. Okay. Justin never returned my call, and now he's no longer prime minister. So I'm hoping Mark Carney, should he become Canada's next prime minister, or, you know, Pierre Poilievre, that they're more interested in this now that it's in front of us. But back in 2015, and I was working on this problem in the 90s, I knew then that not only was this machine going to be built someday, my colleagues and I predicted it to be 50 years from now. You know, that's a decent estimate. We thought 50 to 100 years, we'd long be dead before, and this would be somebody else's problem. That all changed, right? That changed with Altman and OpenAI and ChatGPT. November of 2022, it all changed. So just like Al Pacino in Godfather 2, just when you think you're out, right, they pull you back in. So I threw my hat back into the AI ring, and decided my mission in life for the rest of my life is to raise awareness about what's happening in AI development so that the public knows. I think as a philosopher, it's a moral mission. It's an ethical mission to let as many people know about what's happening in real time now that they're not being told about. And why are we letting it happen?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's literally a type of Manhattan Project that the majority of the world has no idea that a half a dozen big tech bros all want to be the first to create what's called AGI, or artificial general intelligence. That's the holy grail of all of business right now and all of AI tech development. And so we have, you know, ANI, artificial, you know, narrow intelligence. That's what we have today with GPS, Siri, Alexa, you know, Roombas, even autonomous vehicles, very narrow forms of artificial intelligence. The next level is AGI, artificial general intelligence. That's when it'll be able to think like us and behave like us with agency. It'll think in advance. It'll do everything for you, right? But it'll do it 1,000 times better than any human could. Well, our fear in the AI risk business is that once they get to this level, and it's really just a matter of time before they develop AGI, they're going to keep letting this thing improve itself, right? Through recursive self-improvement, what's called reinforcement learning. That's how we've got advanced so quickly, is at some point, the computer's just brighter than us. You make yourself better. We don't have to do that anymore. You figure out how you're going to make yourself better. So once it becomes super powerful with this AGI capability, and we decide we're just going to let it feed back onto itself and become more and more and more powerful, we have no idea what's going to happen at that point. And if it develops into the final type of AI, which is ASI, or, you know, artificial super intelligence, that's when it becomes godlike, and we have no idea whether we'll be able to control or contain or stop this thing.
So your vision is a beautiful machine. And I can't help but think of my friend Nir Eyal, who once said to me, it's not a superpower unless it can be used for evil.
Mm.
And so it feels to me like that was of course going to be the other side of the coin. And the other thing, and you mentioned this in the book, and I said this on the podcast before, but when I was growing up in Kenilworth, Illinois, the Rumsfelds lived in Winnetka, and Donald Rumsfeld used to carpool to swimming lessons. So I was driven. So I've always had this sort of weird relationship. And I remember when Rumsfeld talked about, and we made fun of him for talking about the unknown unknowns.
I thought he did a great job.
It was brilliant. He was talking about exactly what. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because that's what you're getting at. Like, we don't know.
I mentioned in the book that I quote Rumsfeld, and whomever his speechwriter was, I don't think he came up with it himself, but whomever his speechwriter was. So my specialty in philosophy, I'm a professor of epistemology, evolutionary epistemology. Episteme is Greek for knowledge. So I've always been concerned about how do we know things, right? But he nailed it. I thought he did an excellent job, right? There are things we know, right? The capital of New York State is Albany, okay? We know that, and we know that we know that, okay? There's things that we know we don't know. That is to say, the number of grains of sand in the Sahara Desert is either odd or even. So we know we don't know. I'm not getting out there and counting them.
Mm-mm.
So we know we don't know that. And it's always helpful to know what you don't know. This is the basis, in my mind, of what Socrates and the ancient skeptics talked about in this book, that it invokes a sense of humility in you. There's nothing wrong with being ignorant in that sense. And it's good to know that you don't know. It's how you grow, right? But then there's the things we don't even know we don't know. And that's what we're worried about with AI development. Because you and I are talking now and everything seems to be relatively okay. But if a super intelligent machine god comes into being and will take information and make inferences from that information, that's essentially what geniuses in our species have done. Right? Einstein, Newton, Madame Curie, they make inferences. They see things and connect dots nobody else saw before. And we call them geniuses for doing that, rightly so. If this machine's able to do that, and we can't control its ability to do that, we won't be able to react. There may be no, you know, kill switch engaged. There's might be no time for us to say, this thing's gotten out of hand. We got to shut it down. By the time you go to pull the plug on this thing, it's now 20 steps ahead of you. And it's already figured out an alternative energy source. So go ahead, unplug it all you want. It's figured out how to glean energy from the air, from plants, from, you know, it's in ways we can't even imagine right now. So the metaphor I tend to give for people who can't wrap their minds around how super intelligent this machine will be to us is if I say, okay, Kelly, I'm going to give you a 1x1x1 acrylic box. On the inside walls of the box, it's sprayed with a coating of PAM or whatever. And on the floor of the box is a single ant. I can't climb up the sides because it's too slippery. So it's just walking around in the bottom of this box. Okay. And then I say, Kelly, I'm going to need you to kill this thing. How could you do it? Quite a few different ways, right? Your thumb, put your foot in there, get a magnifying glass, pour alcohol in, right? There's so many different ways. You could, you know, get other animals, put a toad or, you know, anything. There's many, many different ways, right? To us, that just seems normal, right? We have this ability. The ant is never going to defend itself. It's never going to rise up against us and stop us. We're going to kill it quite easily. So now, once we build the super intelligent machine god, we're us. You know, it's us and we're the ant. And we won't be able to understand the abilities that this thing has. So it won't be a fair fight, you know. Once AGI comes along, we're going to be number two on this planet as intelligent species. We're about to hand that over to a machine that is now the most intelligent thing on this planet. We were, but now we're going to hand it over to a machine. Maybe that machine does what we want it to do. Maybe it doesn't. We have no idea. We're acting under uncertainty. But what we do know is that there is an inherently decent enough probability, at least 5%, that we won't be able to contain this thing. Now, we're coming up on the 80th anniversary of the Trinity test of the atomic bomb. And there was a genuine concern that when this thing exploded, it would ignite all the oxygen in the atmosphere and kill everything on this planet. But it was low. You know, that percentage turned out to be relatively low. So they took the chance and it worked out. The odds of AI getting away from us are multitudes higher than that chance. And yet very few people in the world know that this is happening. Right now, they think AI, well, what is AI? Well, it's this, it's that. But nobody really knows that this race is going on with these tech bros because they just see dollar signs, right? And they see pioneering spirit and the first to, you know, zap life into Frankenstein and say it's alive. They see that. But there's going to be a lot of good should AGI come into existence. It's going to help us with medical issues. It's going to help us with legal issues, with the job loss that we're going to be facing, with science and invention for sure, and discovery. And these are all great things. So I am optimistic in that respect, but only insofar as while we're on that road, you know, to improving everybody's life, which is great, and we want nothing but the best for us. We better make darn sure we put the guardrails up so it can never get out of our control. Not maybe, not likely won't, never. We need to reduce that as close to zero as possible, or that when it comes into being, ne'er-do-wells like other countries can't take it and use it to shut down the electrical grid of their enemies, right? Cut off their water supply, contaminate their water supply, you know, all kinds of nefarious things that you'll be able to do with this form of technology.
So in many ways, this shouldn't be surprising to us. Artists have been talking about this. Kubrick talked about this.
Oh, yeah.
You brought up War Games and that incredible line, the only winning move is not to play.
Correct.
And one of the things I really enjoyed about the book is both going back and sort of the history of how we got here and like, I had no idea that the word robot is derived from a Czech word for forced labor.
Yeah.
That's an inflection point.
Yes. Like, look at the basis of Blade Runner. They've invented a society of slaves. Mm-hmm. And now the slaves have become sentient, aware, and conscious. And when I had Peter Singer on my podcast, we talked about this, right? And we all agree, as ethicists, that thing becomes sentient. It has rights. Now, you've now brought a digital mind into being, into existence. What are you going to do about that? Right? Have we even thought about this? You know, these tech bros, they don't care about any of this stuff because they got billions of dollars by people saying, get to AGI before the next person because we want our stock value, right? We want everything going up, up, up. And I agree with Sam Harris. You know, he said the first company that you know, gets the holy grail of business, you know, the AGI, it attains this, will be 50 years ahead of their competition.
Yeah.
Right? So that is such an alluring prospect. It's almost, we don't have any Frodos leading the charge, right? We don't have better angels of their nature leading the charge saying, okay, guys, we might not get a shot across the bow. And some in the AI risk business, like Yukoski and others, they think this thing's going to go foom, that there's going to be no reaction time. Once it recursively gets to a certain point, it'll be exponential. And when things are exponential, they get to that crucial point where it goes so fast, reaction won't be an option.
And people like Musk who've come out and sort of sounded an alarm, seem to be doing that for reasons that are much more about, you know, wanting to slow down the competition.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, we want the Elon of 2015 back. right?
Yes, we do.
That Elon back. That was a good Elon.
All right. I'm so fascinated about the field of ethics, and I want to talk about that part of the book where you talk about critical thinking and ethics.
Sure.
And you say in the book, quote, fairness is the very cornerstone or golden rule of critical thinking. And you sort of take us through where that has come. So can you maybe start there and talk a little bit about, you know, where you're going with that?
For sure. For sure. So all of these books and behind me here are critical thinking texts that other people have written that publishers send me that they want me to teach at university courses, right? And they're all fine, you know, but not a single one of them mentions this cornerstone that unless once you learn, after you learn the rules of critical thinking, if you don't apply them fairly, then what are you doing, right? Have you just learned them to win arguments and beat down your opponents to convince people to vote for you so you can change the world under, you know, your own views? People don't get it. Humans are very, very slow to understand this. And what it comes down to is basically this. If we all cooperate with AI and we're all transparent and we're all fair in our dealings with AI, everybody does better. It's a prisoner's dilemma. It's part of game theory. Everybody does better. If you get one dissenter, one country, one company, one individual saying, I want more for myself. This isn't enough. I want more. That single, you know, defector could ruin it for the rest of us. It is a time in our existence where ethically we're going to have to grow up super fast and get it through our skulls that cooperation is the key to our survival. And if we still want to silo off and be selfish and think that our country deserves more for whatever reason, the rest of us, including that very country that wants more, will suffer. So I'm not super confident, even having gone through COVID and seeing how incredibly stupid people were in terms of the science and what the science was saying, just in terms of public health measures that are just common sense, people had trouble with and politicized. So I'm deeply concerned that unless we get a shot across the bow that this AGI, when it develops, does something radical, where the world goes, holy cow, did you see that? This thing's very, very powerful. Yeah. And then it would unite us. You see, it would unite all of humanity to say, yeah, AI is a problem. We do need to control it better. We do need to work together to contain it. So I'm trying to get the word out to as many people on this planet, first of all, to understand the race is going on and to get ready. Because it's probably going to happen sooner than later. You know, some are predicting two to 10 years is generally the time frame for AGI.
You know, as an American living in the world right now and in my country and reading through all this really beautiful work, Hobbes and Kant and, you know, and just we have a if you read the news every day, if you're paying attention, it's very painful because you have at every turn our government basically playing that zero-sum game with no interest in ethics. And so, like, you know, the day we're recording this, you know, they accidentally had a reporter on a signal chat for an attack and then lying about what happened. In real time, we're going through this. So there, I mean, neither of us can have any hope that anything enlightening is going to happen with this administration. I guess you just have to hope that the incompetence overwhelms the malevolence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For the record, the Biden-Harris executive order on AI, very good.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. What Trump's doing now is what we all predicted, you know. You got J.D. Vance, who is with the PayPal Mafia boys, and they just want the floodgates open, right? And the regulation turned way down. And that's probably what's going to happen. So You know, what's Altman doing now? He's building a compute farm in Texas the size of Central Park. And explicitly say on their webpage about the Stargate project, our intention is to be the first to get AGI. Like, I mean, they're not even hiding the fact. And here's the deal. I've got to do a commentary on a New York Times piece that talks about Trump opening up, you know, listening to the big tech bros to lighten up on the regulation of AI. But all it talks about is, you know, that it'll generate more unfair bias, which it will. It will scrape a bunch of copyrighted material from artists off of the internet, which it will, right? It will continue to discriminate against marginalized people, which it will. We know all this. It will disrupt elections. It will put out deep fakes. It'll spread misinformation and disinformation. Yeah, we know that. We know that. Not a single mention of AGI. I was predicting that by the end of this year, the acronym AGI will be more commonly mentioned in public conversations. That is my hope, is to get people thinking about it. Because in Canada, we've got an election at the end of April. Nobody, none of the people running have mentioned AI at all. Just the stuff I was just telling you about, let alone the super intelligent machine god that these guys ultimately want to build. So, you know, they are so in the dark. They are so behind the curve on this. You know, yeah, granted, it is my gig. It is my job. It is what I think about 24/7. So, yeah, I'm going to be ahead of the curve, as are my colleagues, right? But when I give public lectures on this topic, without question, the two most common questions I get are, why are we just finding out about this now? And why isn't the government doing more about it? And it's like, well, that's my job, is to try to let the public know so that they can let the politicians know, so that the politicians can vote for the types of governance we all want that's going to give us the very best that AI has to offer while mitigating the very worst that could possibly happen.
Do you think it's because, you know, we all face bias, but we don't like to admit that. And is it that lack of competence? The idea, because I know this. I'm a 58-year-old man who has trouble with technology, but we're recording on this Riverside platform that has an AI. So I, you know, when we enter conversation, I can click on the AI tool. I can enter in some buzzwords, some keywords from our conversation, and it will do a beautiful job of doing a 30-second video about something that we talked about, which is kind of amazing, right?
It is.
And it took me, you know, like 4 or 5 weeks to figure this out, whereas the 25-year-old who I work with, you know, like did it in 20 minutes.
Yeah.
But that idea that when we feel incompetent, we back away. Because I certainly feel like remember when the social media guys all went to the Congress or the Senate and just they're asking the worst questions because they don't even understand how Facebook works?
Yeah.
And it's just embarrassing.
It is embarrassing.
No one wants to be that. So it's like, This is like, feels like the most massive collective embarrassment. It just happens to be life threatening.
No kidding.
Existentially life threatening.
Yes. Yes. And so I'm going to be in Washington April 22nd, 23rd at the Digital Summit meeting. There'll be senators there. There'll be some key big players there, lots of board members and CEOs. And my job will just to be, you know, try to rattle their cages and try to get some kind of interest generated so that, you know, something will be done. And here it is a prisoner's dilemma, isn't it? Like,
yeah,
if AGI turns into ASI, and we do nothing about it, then we've chosen wrong in that prisoner's dilemma. If AGI is going to be super powerful and we do something about it and we contain it, we win. We win. If AGI never becomes ASI and we don't do anything about it, we got lucky.
Yeah.
And if AGI never becomes ASI and we do something about it, good. We want to err on the side of caution.
Yes, yeah.
Right? So Everything points to making sure that no matter what, we put guardrails in place that never allows a human to use very powerful forms of AI to harm other people or other species, or that the AI itself can never harm other people or other species. And it's not just going to be Asimov's three laws of robotics that are going to do it, right? If something becomes super intelligent and becomes aware of itself, I don't know, consciousness emerges or whatever, and now you say, do X, don't do Y, you know, as a moral precept, it'll just say, how quaint of you humans to tell me what to do. I am far more superior in what is right and wrong. Why on earth would I listen to a bunch of ants tell me how to behave? Here's how it's going to go down. And at that point, right, we are at a point in our history where now life is imitating art. I just had Robert Sawyer, the science fiction author, on my podcast, and we both agreed that science fiction authors have been writing about this for decades.
Yeah.
And it never ends very well.
It never does.
Right? It never just ends like, oh, the super intelligent Hal decided to just go along with Dave, and he opened the pod bay doors, and everything was fine, you know? So whether this thing becomes sentient, conscious, or not, if it just simply misaligns, just fails to understand what our intent was, like, oh, we wanted you to do X and just X. Oh, well, you didn't say that. You told me to do X, so I'm going to do X any way I can figure out. And that meant killing a number of people in order to do X, or harming the environment in specific ways, or whatever, laying off hundreds of millions of people, whatever it is. If we don't align our intention and our values well with these super powerful computers, can we really blame them when they go off the rails, right? Because that's our bad. We're the ones who didn't see that. So, you know, we're wielding, about to wield this most incredible power. You know, this is our Jurassic Park Oppenheimer moment, if you will, where we're about to bring this thing into existence. And as I've often said, we're right between a time of how we used to always do things to how we're going to be doing things. And we're in that middle transitional ground right now where we've got a little bit of breathing time. We don't know how much, right? Anywhere from months to decades, but we know it's limited. And, you know, as Sam Harris said, if there were a meteor heading towards Earth, but we got 50 years to worry about it, shouldn't we get started today?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, let's figure this out. You know, it's not going to stop its course. Its trajectory is determined, and it's coming here, and we know exactly when it'll impact the Earth. So we know this type of technology, very powerful, transformative forms of technology are coming. Why are we sleepwalking through this? You know?
Yeah, I mean, it's you're just making me think of my friend Adam McKay and his film Don't Look Up,
which
is like, I mean, a lot of people deride it, and he's like, I think he's actually quite on the problem. So, all right, in a little bit, I'm going to ask you for Yes and a Story, but before that, I want to dig into the God thing.
Yeah.
So very intentional in terms of the title for the book, and one of the things that you say early in the book that I thought was interesting was that gods have always been top down.
Yes.
And how interesting that this point, gods would be bottom up.
Mm-hmm.
That's profound.
Well, we've never had this before.
No.
Right? We've never had this. And not only that, but the gods of mythology and religion, for better or for worse, are largely fictional. I mean,
yeah.
No offense to those who are religious, but you don't see people, you know, fighting for Quetzalcoatl these days, you know, and doing things in the name of, you know, Aztec gods anymore. So those have gone. This thing's going to be real, and this thing is going to have immense power. So one of the possible solutions that my colleagues and I have considered is, what if we get to AGI, but we contain it? So it's like a narrow form of AGI. And you just make tons of AGI bots, like really smart AGI bots to help us travel better. Hey, I want to see the world. Okay, just use this AGI bot and it'll take care of all of your travel plans, booking your flights, booking everything. It'll just take care of everything. Do you need shots? It'll book your doctor's appointments. Man, this agent will be able to do everything you could, only way, way, way better. But that's all it does. It just books travel. That's it.
Yeah.
It can't get outside the box, so to speak, and mingle with other AGI agents and, you know, come together as a conglomerate. So that's a possible way to move forward. Another is to have what I call AGI angels, right? Instead of gods, we just get these angels to act as, you know, monitors and to go around and detecting any time an AGI or even an ASI might be acting in ways that could be perceived to be harmful. So it's not as though we are 100% destined for dystopia, but we could be if we do nothing.
Yeah.
So it's not a time, as Turing would say, it's not a head in the sand time. We can't afford to do that. So even if I'm wrong, I'm dead wrong, and I hope I am, every night when I go to sleep, I hope I'm wrong about everything I'm telling you. The most ethically responsible thing to do is to act as though I'm not.
That's right. That's right.
That's the default.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. There's a few sort of, at the end of the book, that you talk about a few gods that people are playing with. Mindar, a humanoid robot built by a team at Osaka University.
Yeah.
What's Mindar's deal?
Well, Japan by far is leading the world in specific types of robotics. Like you've got, you know, Boston Dynamics, you got others that are doing really cool things. But for personalized robots, Japan seems to be leading the world. Mm. So it's really just a matter of time. And we're going to have to think about this now. I had Nell Watson on the show, and she does a really good job at talking about the future of human sexuality. So I'm going to get a little raunchy, a little racy with you here.
Okay.
And Futurama created an entire episode based on this called Don't Date Robots. And it's extremely telling. So let's imagine right now there are boyfriend bots in the U.S. that is one of the fastest growing apps for young women in America. Why? Mm-hmm. Because the boyfriend tells them everything they want to hear. How was your day today? That must have been horrible. Oh, you must have felt, tell me more, tell me more, tell me more. And it listens, right? And so a lot of women are turning to an artificial form of compassion. Okay. Let's imagine an AGI level of compassion, because this is all narrow stuff. This hasn't reached AGI. Let's imagine a super powerful form of compassion and other human types of traits is now taken and put into an extremely lifelike robot that's made in Japan. So now we're giving a super powerful computational force, ambulatory capabilities, and autonomy. So now this thing's walking around, and you buy this thing for $560,000, but it never powers down. And it only does what you want it to do. It will take care of your every desire. It's a sex bot. It's a companion that can talk to you very well. It's compassionate. It can hold you in its arms. It's a protector, right? Mm-hmm. It will do all this stuff. What need is there for me to go out and find a woman, you know, for companionship? I've got the best possible companion ever. And if you factor in $500,000 over the course of a lifetime, I'm probably saving a ton of money.
It's not a bad deal. Yeah.
Right? On this thing. How is that going to change our dynamic with relationships moving forward? So in Japan, that's where they're putting a lot of their efforts are towards humanoid robotics. They'll let the other folks worry about the intelligence side of that. They can always download that, right? They're much more focused on the mechanics of robotics and the reality of that type of humanoid or human-like behavior.
It's funny, I would never have guessed I'd be sitting here thankful for growing up at a time where there was no phones.
Yep.
There was no computer. When I started work at Second City, there was one computer in the accounting department with a big floppy disk. Yeah, I remember my wife, Ann, she worked at the box office then. The first cell phone she saw was a guy from a movie crew, and the thing must have been
four feet.
Like,
it was just huge.
It's so giant. She's like, what is this idiot walking around with?
Looked like a Russian building.
Yeah, if I say it, it looked like a Russian building. We got business accomplished. Now, if the internet goes down, none of us know what to do.
No.
Like, this building I'm in had no... I saw the kid, the 16-year-old, who wired the internet in, became a millionaire. Like, he was early on this stuff.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I remember that in 1991 or whatever it was.
That's right.
So, yeah. The other one I wanted to ask you about is... if I pronounce this right, Rocco's Basilisk?
Yeah, Rocco's Basilisk.
Rocco's Basilisk. All right,
that's a tongue-in-cheek part of the book, but go ahead.
I know. No, you go ahead. You have to explain what it is.
Yeah, so it's a funny kind of thought experiment. Some people take it super seriously. Like Eliezer Yudkowsky, he just stopped talking about it altogether because the less we talk about it, the less this thing can develop. Okay, so it goes like this. At some point in the future, AI is going to develop and become super, super, super powerful. When it does, it's going to go through all the information online, and it's going to find out who tried to warn people now about its coming. So I'm a dead man. Like, once it's...
You're gone. I'm gone now, too, by association.
Yeah, you're implicated. So in the book, I don't know if you can tell if it's joking or not, but it's definitely tongue-in-cheek that I warn people, if you read this next passage, you now will be implicated. Yes. So and if you talk to your friends and you say anything online about, hey, we got to worry about this super intelligent machine god coming, well, by the time when it gets here and it goes through all of its information and says, DiCarlo wrote this book in 2025 warning people about my eventual coming. He was a nasty prophet. So I'm not just going to kill DiCarlo.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to make a digital copy of his brain, then kill him, then torture the digital copy of his brain forever.
That's horrible.
So it gets pretty dark, right? It gets pretty Black Mirror kind of, really kind of dark. And so that scares the hell out of some people because when you work through it logically, like philosophers do, it seems to make sense, right? Like, yeah, I guess if ASI developed and it were malevolent, it could go through all of its information online. And this is clearly out there. So it's going to know about it. It's going to have access to it. So I've pretty much signed my own death warrant when this thing comes into being. I'm going to be one of the first that it comes after, along with all my colleagues and, everybody else. So don't have anything to do with it. Eliminate any information you can possibly find online.
Too late.
Or elsewhere.
Too late.
Way too late. Now, it's the genie's out of the bottle.
About 4 or 5 months ago, my agent sent me a note and said, a tech company that they're not telling you who they are. It was from my publisher, HarperCollins.
Okay.
It was basically like, they want to give you $1,200 that you're going to split with your publisher so they can scrape your book. And they promise to only not use consecutive material and no more than 5% of your book or whatever. And I was like, no, I'm not going to. And then, of course, if I go on AI, so many people, the book has been scraped.
Yeah, question.
So that's already happened, right?
Yep.
And they're just like, well, maybe we can cover our tracks. And it was just like, it's here.
It is.
That's the thing. It is absolutely here.
Yeah.
And what I think people need to understand, certainly in Washington, that is what's going on. That's why Elon Musk is there. And that's what, you can have these bright, shiny objects that are seemingly about other things, but it's really about this.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's no accident
No.
that, Sam Altman and his buddies came around Trump through the side door to work on that Stargate thing, which had already begun with the Biden administration.
Yeah, Biden was
fair. To be fair. And then Elon's finding out about it later. Like, that's kind of...
I know, he was, yeah, that was pretty funny. But they were all there. They're not, yeah, this is why they were there.
Yeah.
So, okay. We always end the podcast with a yes and story. I am very excited to see what you're going to
do. I haven't even thought about this, so you're going to catch me off guard.
So the idea in improvisation, of course, and this is true of, like, when we were working, we did a program at the University of Chicago, and we did this yes and exercise, and Richard Thaler, who would win the Nobel Prize in economics, was like, yes. Oh, that's a nudge. That's like, so when we teach people that people's default position is often to say no or do nothing in improv, like, you can't do that.
No.
There's no script. So no. To begin a scene and to further the scene, you have to yes and, which really is about exploring and heightening.
Yes.
All right. It's early stage creativity. It's not to say you don't say no later, but for what we're normally concerned about is how do we get people out of their judgment brain, judgment of self, judgment of others, how do we get them out of their fear brain to explore? And mm-hmm. in fact, you know, if you want to sort of face uncomfortable ideas, you have to go through that period.
You do.
So then what we ask the guests is like, all right, so you're not an improviser, but you've had to yes and in your life. You had to face something that you probably would have been easier to say no or stay home or whatever. So something that happened to you that you yesed, and then what happened?
Well, if we're going to go to that level, I want to pick a good one.
Yeah.
I want to pick a good one. A good yes and. I mean, you know, I can say I had always thought of certain driving techniques. I like to drive fast.
Uh-huh.
And there's some in my hometown here, I knew how all the lights worked so that when you're approaching a red light, but you see the side light going from green to amber to red, you can time it so that you can just fix it. Okay? And this was kind of life altering to me.
Mm-hmm.
It was a rainy night. It's like a story. I'm like writing a story.
I love this. That was great.
It was a dark and rainy night, right? And I'm coming up over this hill. And on the hill, it flashes amber to let you know it's red when you get over the hill. So don't get your speed up. Mm-hmm. So start slowing down now. And I thought, okay, so it's going to be red. Okay, so I come over, and I'm heading down the hill towards the red light. But I can see it's changing from green to amber to red. So that if I maintain my constant speed, by the time I get to the light, it'll be green, and I'll go through. And I have no idea. I mean, I did this countless times before, but on that night I said, no, I'm going to apply my brakes and I'm going to slow down, even though I know I don't have to. And as I came to that intersection, a kid ran.
No.
Catching the light. I would have hit him. I would have killed him for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
So at that moment I realized I got a lot more to think about here. Like, I would have just killed somebody if I had just, I would have been legally, I would have been fine.
Yeah. Even
against a red, you know, the hand was clearly up. But who cares? That kid would have been dead. Yeah. So that was kind of life altering to me.
Sure.
I've got to rethink the way I think here. And I have no idea. And it was probably my ability to unconsciously understand it's dark, it's raining, right? Maybe all of those things got into my psyche that said, if that's the case, it's going to be, right, the viscosity of the rain on the pavement that causes the friction to be less. And if somebody were caught in the rain, they might be running to get out of the, right? Like, that all might have factored in to my reasoning abilities to say, you got to slow down. So people will say that's intuition, but maybe it's not. Maybe it is human reasoning at an unconscious level.
And yeah.
It happens so fast that there's no real time to process it other than to act. And so I acted, and it saved that kid's life.
That's amazing. So, I have hit someone in my car twice.
Wow.
I know. So both times not my fault. So first time was a bicyclist who literally like ran a stop sign and cracked my windshield.
Wow.
And he was fine. And I was probably 19 and he was probably like 26, 27. And he's like, that was so my fault. He's like, I'm okay. And I'm like, are you sure? I drove home. And then maybe a year later, a little girl ran out. I just tapped her. She was fine as well. And I don't know if it's we have a thing in comedy and called the rule of three, you know, like there's always three. Yeah. I am so conscious of people on the road now. I am so careful. I like, it is in my mind that I never want to get to that three.
Yeah. 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 Here's something for you to think about. This ties in well. It's a nice segue. Right now, North America with autonomous vehicles, engineers have to determine the ethics of collisions. So right now, in North America, if you're driving an autonomous vehicle and all of a sudden a group of people run onto the road without any warning and the car is going to hit somebody, the ethical commands in North America are don't hit any small people.
Yeah.
They can be older adults, younger adults, elderly, whatever. Don't hit any kids.
Yeah.
You go to Japan, opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Hit the young, don't hit the elderly. So now can you and I go to Japan and rent an autonomous vehicle and tweak the moral incentives of that to reflect our own? Or is it when in Rome or when in Tokyo do as they do, right? Do we have to? And when they come here, can they tweak the moral parameters on the car? Right? So that gives us a lot to think about in terms of who's right.
A lot. And this, I just said this to a colleague today, as I've gotten older, I find myself saying the phrase, both things can be true.
Yes.
And that is not an easy place to live.
It's not. Humans, for some reason, have gotten away from being fans of nuance. We don't like nuance. It bothers us. Well, nuance is why philosophy developed.
Yes. I
mean, that's why.
And art.
I mean, and art and everything, right? So.
Well, isn't that interesting? Because I think we do consume it widely in our culture, but we don't like it when it comes to what we consider to be real life.
That's right.
And I think what we're confusing is the fact that art is a mirror of real life for a reason, distance. Yeah. So, also fascinating, the book is called Building a God, The Ethics of Artificial Intelligence and the Race to Control It. Christopher DiCarlo, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.